Welcome back to the Global Greek Influence Podcast. I'm Panagiota Pimenidou. To be up to date with the news from the Global Greek Influence Podcast and suggest your topics, subscribe, like, and review the Global Greek Influence Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Anchor FM, Amazon Music, and four more podcasting platforms. You can contact the Global Greek Influence through the podcast's Facebook and Twitter accounts, the podcast website globalgreekinfluence.com, and LinkedIn page. Professor Alexandros Psychogios is my guest today. Alexandros is a leadership and international HRM professor and director of research at Birmingham City Business School in the UK. He has a BSc in political science and public administration from the University of Athens in Greece, an MSc in public policy and public finance, an MA in services management from the University of York in the UK, and a PhD in industrial and business studies from the University of Warwick in the UK. He's also a visiting professor at several universities in Europe and Asia. Alexandros is an expert in leadership and complexity science, organizational neuroscience, international human resource management, small and medium enterprise management, and total quality and performance management. In August 2020, he received from the Management Consulting Division of the Academy of Management and Benedictine University Award for Outstanding Research Work on Ethical Issues in Consulting for his work on crisis leadership. Welcome to the show, Alexandre.
Thank you very much, Panagiota, and thank you very much for your invitation to your podcast.
You're welcome, and I'm very happy you are with us here today. All over today's economic sectors, including academia and research, we look for leadership trends and recommendations for becoming future-ready leaders. Many adjectives have been used for a future leader: transformative, adaptive, agile. And when we look into their details, we see skills cross-sectioning these models. At the same time, we predict the future needs of leaders based on what we foresee as future challenges overarching most sectors, such as building the capacity of the people and the organization, workplaces becoming more experimental and data-driven, even looking into the shortages of qualified employees when organizations need to reskill and upskill their workforces. Your research links neuroscience with leadership, and you published the book Neuroscience for Leaders, A Brain-Adaptive Leadership Approach. What tools of neuroscience can one use to advance leadership?
Thank you so much for the question. First of all, to say that leadership is a very complex phenomenon. As we say in the book, leadership is not a science per se. Okay, we study leadership from the scientific point of view. We use a variety of scientific approaches in order to understand leadership. However, leadership is not a science per se. It's not an art either. For us, it's a behavior. So as a behavior, has a lot of different interpretations, one. Two, it can be influenced by a variety of different factors. A very particular factor that influences the way that we behave as leaders, either formal leaders in organizations or informal leaders in a group of people, with our friends, within our families, is defined by our brain. So the way that we behave, we know this, neuroscience, modern neuroscience actually has proved this, that the brain defines the way that we behave. Therefore, if we assume that leadership is a behavior, leadership, in turn, is also influenced by the brain. So what we try to do through this research, that it is an ongoing research, let me say that, is to identify these aspects that can help mainly professional leaders, professional managers, and other type of leaders in order to improve their capabilities in leading and managing people inside organizations. In a sense, there are no particular tools that we can use. What we say instead, that there are particular concepts, ideas, practices. For example, in the book, we claim about a practice that we call, or a framework, if you like, that we call as brain adaptive leadership framework, that consists of four pillars: the thinking pillar, the emotional pillar, the brain automation pillar and the relations pillar. And within each of these pillars, we give specific recommendations, always based on the insights that are coming from neuroscience. There are ideas, a lot of ideas, not only our idea out there. There are a lot of ideas, there are a lot of concepts, there are a lot of practices that neuroscience can bring first to the study of leadership, but most importantly, to the practice of leadership.
I understand from your description that leadership is something personal to individuals based on their tendencies as characters and personalities. So one wonders, when it comes to developing a leadership style or to be up to date with current or future leadership styles, should they consciously harness the best out of their characters and personalities and suppress those elements that are not so favorable for that style of leadership?
Very interesting question and very to the point, I think. Leadership is not something that belongs only to the leader. Leadership, as I said before, is a complex phenomenon that if someone wants to understand leadership, he or she needs to observe the leader trying to interact with whom? With the follower or the followers. Okay, and the interaction between the two consists this phenomenon of leadership, and always this interaction, it is not happening on a given all the time environment, but this environment that we call context is changing all the time. So leader, if we'd like to understand leadership, leadership is not only the leader, is the leader interacting with the follower in a particular context. Following this rationale, yes, leaders, which is definitely a very specific part of this framework, leader, follower, and context, they need to have some capabilities in order to influence the followers. But these capabilities, they need to be adjustable, adaptive, agile. You referred to these keywords before in your first question. And yes, sometimes this is actually the essence of agility, if you like. This is the essence of adaptiveness, if you like. They need not to suppress in a sense, but they need to put in the forefront their very best aspects of their character, of their personality, in order to, as we say in practice, to give the right example, to lead by example. Because leading by example, or if you like, having the appropriate behavior is the trigger that will influence the follower to follow, and of course, in turn, to follow to do the same as the leader does. There is ton of research, especially in behavioral economics, confirming that the leader, the presence of a leader in a context, in a group of people, is extremely important for the good or bad performance of the group. So, in order to make my answer more specific, yes, there are times that the leader needs to put at the forefront. This is the expression that I would use, the best of themselves in order to be able to lead properly.
Through this answer, you described how or what the characteristics of an adaptive leader are. At the same time, an adaptive leader does not stand on their own. Most often, such leaders are part of an organization. So one wonders, what is the relationship between one who pursues to become an adaptive leader and their organization, or else how invested are organizations and businesses in adaptive leadership?
Yeah, that's also very, very interesting. And the answer is not easy. There is another paradox, as we like to say. And the paradox is that although most of the organizations, they like these new ideas of leadership, adaptive, agile, etc., at the same time, in reality, very few of them, they invest on it. What I mean, leadership as a behavior is governed primarily by our inner selves and inner dynamics. These inner dynamics, the dynamics of the brain, they do not necessarily follow the exogenous, the outside rules that the organization usually applies. So the paradox is hidden on the needs of the leader to be adaptive. Adaptive to what? Adaptive to the situation and adaptive to the needs of the people to lead. But at the same time, the leader needs to follow the rules and the regulation that the organization puts all over the people that work for this organization. So in practice, there are only very few efforts that have been observed out there that organizations, they practically develop adaptive skills of leaders, of their managers, by either eliminating rules or, you know, creating a more human environment rather than a more procedural, technical environment inside organizations. There are examples. Unfortunately, these examples are less than the majority of organizations. There is, of course, a rationale out there. I mean, the majority of professional managers, especially those at the top levels, they would say the main target is to have an organization running properly. So we cannot afford the risk of eliminating rules or making the situation much easier for people. But this is the key for me, though. The time that organizations will realize that adaptive leadership as a skill can be emerged only if we create the appropriate environment inside the organization, this will be the time that we're going to see more positive results.
Many of us have migrated, as you and I have migrated and relocated from our region and have worked in the North and West Europe, but we also had professional experience in Southeast Europe. And many people will migrate and continue to relocate due to financial, also in the future due to climate change. So focusing in your personal experience or in areas where you have worked, what are the geographical differences in HR management between Northwest and Southeast Europe?
Yeah, a lot. There are tons of research, again, confirming that there are very robust cultural and institutional factors that influence the way that we behave formally or informally inside organizations. And this, of course, applies not only in European countries or among European countries. If we focus on Europe, I would say that the specific cultural characteristics of the North definitely define the way that management and HR management in particular will be applied. The same, I would say, that applies in southern countries. One typical example, if I can use, is the way that we behave in health and safety issues. At North, for example, it's a very important issue and it is culturally driven. So there are plenty of rules, a lot of regulations trying to secure that there will be less risk working on site or doing whatever specific things. If now you compare a typical organization in the north of Europe with a typical organization in South Europe, a national level organization, I'm not talking about the multinational organizations, you can see that in the South, for example, they are not so strict with health and safety rules and regulations, which indicates this cultural and, of course, institutional differences. Based on this example, there are more examples on HR, for example, on the way that recruitment is taking place, on the way that the performance evaluation is taking place, and the use of performance evaluation. Performance evaluation is considered the heart of human resource management. So you can see companies doing performance evaluation, appraising the performance of people for a year, just because they need just to tick the box. And this is usually happening in organizations that they don't actually believe in this practice. There are other organizations in other countries that they take a proper advantage of this practice. So they link the appraisal of performance of their people to the actual development of their people or to the reward of the people in life. As you can understand, there are always a lot of differences, and this is actually the way that we try to understand and to study. In international human resource management, there is a term, there are two terms actually, that are called convergence-divergence, and there is always, this this fight between the two. To what extent HR practices are the same, convergence, and to what extent HR practices are diverse, divergence. And there are evidence confirming both. So as you can understand, since there are evidence of empirical studies that they're confirming both, this means that still no one can claim that there is a convergence. So although we are living in a globalized society, no one can convince that we have a convergence of HR practices, so all the practices are similar, neither that there are only differences. So the truth is between the two.
How could the Southeast Europe HR management impact adaptive leadership and assist brain gain?
Well, if I would say I don't know, that would be, it's honestly a difficult question. What I would suggest for those that they work in a Southeastern European context, business context, is to, and I think that most of them, they do so, is to try to understand the context primarily. What this means? This means that if, for example, we have a manager, he or she used to work in an Anglo-Saxon country, UK or US, having experienced specific ways of managing people. And let's assume that this manager finds a very good job opportunity in Greece or in another Southeastern European country. The worst thing that this manager can do is to copy-paste, practically transfer without any, you know, adjustment, his or her experience over there to the Southeastern European context. So the first thing in order to develop adaptiveness is to understand the context that we are working. It's extremely important for me. Things that can be successful and applied elsewhere doesn't mean that they can apply in every single context, especially things related to managing people. You don't manage an IT system, you don't try to make an accounting or finance plan, which are a lot of similarities in both cases, and practically they can be developed in a similar way. But when you deal about when you have to deal with people, you need to understand that people will influence about the cultural and institutional context, and this cultural and institutional context are not the same; they differ. And if you do not adjust yourself in this context in order to find ways to lead them properly, then most probably you are not going to be successful. So what I suggest is to give time to yourself, especially if you move to a different culturally and institutionally oriented country. These things cannot necessarily work as they used to work in a different context because of these differences.
During times of crisis and global changes, we tend to turn inwards and see cooperation and multilateralism fading. Yet, that is when we should strive for collaboration and joint teamwork. What are the keys to, and how could we develop dynamic relationships under crisis and global changes?
Yes, you are right. This is happening usually when we have to deal with a crisis situation. We are much more inward. However, and this is something that all of us, we need to understand, and this is something not it's coming from my lips as my opinion, but this is something that is coming from neuroscience, is that biologically we are programmed to collaborate. In collaboration, our survival is hidden, not in our ability to survive in an isolated environment by ourselves. To belong in a group, to collaborate with a group, and all together to achieve something is a necessity for a human. And the same applies in professional and not professional circumstances. Again, the role of leadership, especially during a crisis period, is amazingly important. The leader is the one that will symbolize the way that we need to deal with a crisis. If the leader will behave in an inward way, obviously will be copied by the followers. But if the leaders understand that this is the time that we need to listen more, to discuss with each other, to admit fear because crisis, the dominant emotion that is present during a crisis is fear. And it's not, you know, a weakness to admit fear as a leader. It's not weakness to say to the others, I understand your fears. And for example, during this critical period of time, what you need to mainly concern is about your families, your spouses, your own people. And we are here as an organization and as a group in order to support you. These are the things that people, they want to hear. Not the things that, you know, pretend that nothing is happening, business as usual and stuff like that. Because no matter what you're going to say to your people, if the crisis is coming, then they are going to find ways to save themselves. I had the opportunity at the beginning of this unfortunate war that is happening in the moment to give an online seminar to Ukrainians. Ukrainians business managers online during the first two months. And actually, it was under the series of repeated seminars, especially that started with COVID crisis. And I was saying to them exactly the same, that it is important to show this this sense of collaboration, this sense of we are a team, we are a group, we are all together, to your people in order to convince them to do the same with their own people as well. Because collaboration for me is the key. And believe it or not, biologically speaking, we are programmed, let me use this term, we are programmed to collaborate.
Knowledge-intensive companies conduct research, development, innovation, or skill employees under innovation conditions. How can innovative, knowledge-intensive companies set the paradigm to lead people and organizations?
Well, these companies, they belong to this small sample, small group of companies, that most of them, not all of them, that I was saying before. If you observe the most innovative companies on this planet, not now, for years now, what they have done is to try to follow a more bottom-up approach, meaning that they were trying primarily to create environments that they enhance creativity, because innovation, it is rooted in human creativity. Humans innovate, not computers, okay, at least for the moment. So they have managed to create these environments that enhance human creativity. One of the things that I was amazed reading, there is a book which is called Finding the Next Steve Jobs, written by the owners of Atari, I think. Atari, for those of us that we are older, you know, we remember these video games during the 80s. In these companies in Silicon Valley, actually, these people that they authored the book, these two authors, they were the first people that recruited Steve Jobs. So Steve Jobs primarily worked for them. And they were describing very nice stories inside this book about what they have done. So, for example, a typical knowledge-intensive company and creative industry like this, like an IT company, uses a lot of software engineers. So they were describing about the case that somehow a software engineer came and said to them, look, guys, I'm better when I'm working during night. But according to the rules of the company, the premises, they need to be closed down 8 o'clock, and the security guys throw us out. I want to stay during night and work in my projects. And actually, this is what they do. They eliminate the rule and they said, okay, you can do that. And then another guy came and liked the idea and wanted to do the same. And then some other guys went to them and said, you know, guys, because we're staying during the night, can we have actually showers? Because for the moment, we have only toilets. Can we have also showers? Because we'd like to have a shower from time to time. And they built it showers over there. So this is a typical way that I create the environment that people need in order to enhance their creativity. If you have another way to do so, please say to me. But there is no any other way, honestly. This situation is dramatic in a lot of companies, you know, because, you know, innovation is a buzzword and a lot of people, they use it, you know, just, you know, every single day. They say, I want you to innovate. I want you to do new things, new stuff. But at the same time, they say to you, you can do these things, but you need to follow 100 rules. So practically they say to you, think outside of the box by being inside the box. How you can do that? Some people, they haven't realized that, or some people, they do realize this, but, you know, because simply they don't care, or they don't want to give the fight, they say, it is what it is. Okay, we're going to follow it. This is the ugly truth, I'm afraid. The moment that we will realize that the way to, you know, to enhance innovation is to create these appropriate environments that enhance innovation, would be the moment, I think, that more organizations, and not only the knowledge-intensive organizations, will be able to develop further creativity and human ideas.
This reminds me a little bit of the Horizon programs, the most recent ones that are looking for innovation, while at the same time they tell you what they want to achieve. So they're asking you to deliver solutions rather than innovate. And yes, you innovate something that has been deemed unsuccessful, but they considered it as an innovation.
Yeah. The same applies with business plans. European Union, first of all, let's be honest, is one of the biggest bureaucracies ever. Okay, bureaucracy is not there to enhance innovation, doesn't care about innovation. And from a point of view, if you think of it, this is not their target. Innovation is not their target. Bureaucracy, it is there in order to control a situation, in order to keep a situation under control, which I totally understand. Okay.
You're going to be accused as a Brexiteer now.
Yeah. Okay. we need sometimes, you know, to criticize things and in order to be able to improve things. I'm not saying that it's a wrong thing to do. It's a political primarily organization. Okay, let's be honest. And as a political organization, it needs to be bureaucratic. The problem that you referred is very typical. Started with the previous frame on program 6 and 7, etc., that they were asking, for example, to develop innovations with SMEs by writing a 5 years business plan. 5 years business, you know, as an academic, I can easily write business plan. It's not a problem for me. Now, the question is, how many of these business plans that the European Union, for example, were asking in all these Horizon FP7, 6 programs are becoming true is a different story. Someone that believes that the business plan can actually predict the actual future, what will happen, I think is far away from, you know, being down to the earth. Now, why the European Union asks for a business plan? It's because they want actually to see that there is something in the mind that coordinates the whole process of innovation of whatever. But the truth is that this is by default the paradox, because innovation, it means that I'm experiment myself with some things, I'm open and tolerate mistakes, I can manage the risk, of course, not whatever mistakes, okay, I can manage the risk, and I go on. It's not random, Panagiota, that most of the inventions, I think that I was reading this somewhere, most of the greatest invention in the history of humankind, they were invented randomly. So practically the people that were trying to do something else and they ended up with the invention. And this means a lot, I think.
As an engineer and as a researcher, the way I perceive innovation is that you cannot expect to have from the beginning or the way you visualize your work what outcomes you're going to get to. And all these great inventions we have today come from people to whom nobody put on any expectations what the outcome would be. Unfortunately, we are asked to innovate based on targets. So this is just to deliver a solution. And that innovation that the European Union or a company might consider might be wrong to start with, might be defective to start with. So they're asking us to innovate on something defective because they have invested, because somebody convinced them that that was the right thing to do. So we keep on building to try to achieve to deliver something that fundamentally is not working.
You are right. Now, in order to avoid doing ourselves a mistake here, we're not against targets. It's not a bad thing to have a target. It's not a bad thing to have an idea. Okay, I would like to develop that, for example. But this is different than to say that there is no any other way, but you need to do this.
Why don't they allow researchers to actually come up with new concepts, new ideas? It's unfortunate that we are missing other opportunities and even better solutions.
True.
But of course, this might sound a philosophical conversation to most business people and to most people who are in the decision making, especially in politics. Now, to move on to in our conversation, by combining adaptive leadership and innovative knowledge intensive companies, what is the role of an adaptive leader in stimulating innovation in an organization?
It is linked to what I said before. An adaptive leader, if he or she wants to enhance innovation, he or she needs to find ways to give to the people that they will innovate, the experts maybe or someone, the framework to do so. How they can do this? One of the things that I do, for example, in my business school, as a director of research, meaning that I'm a manager, I manage people as well, and I have targets with them. And some of them are related to innovation in the sense that research is something that brings something new. I try hard, not always with success though, to facilitate, make them focus on what they need to do, take out of their responsibility things that can be done either by someone else. Maybe some of them are necessary, but definitely not directly related to what they need to do. Some procedural things and stuff like that. Or to say, look, this is the procedure, but for me, give a specific emphasis on step 2, step 4, and step 7, for example. And forget about the others. They are not that much important for the moment, at least. Or we're going to find another way. But I'm doing that. I don't suggest to do the same, but I'm suggesting that adaptive leadership requires, as I said, to understand the context, to think what I want to achieve. If I want to achieve people innovation, people creativity, then I'm afraid that you need to find the ways to facilitate. How you're going to do that, it's something that each one of you know better than anyone else. I'm doing, as I described before, specific things in my case, but this is my case. In your case, you may need to do something different, but you need to do something. And this is to facilitate this innovation process.
So practically, how can an aspiring leader bridge the gap between innovating and their ability to execute? Are there any steps? Are there any rules such a leader can follow?
No, there are not. I'm in leadership. I'm against, personally, as I said before, I belong to a school of thought that is against leadership based on rules. Leadership is a complex phenomenon. Every single leader has his, her own way of leading. Some of us more successful, some of us less. Leadership, also the success, whatever success means, does not depend on the leader only. Have that in your mind. The success depends heavily on the follower, the situation. Luck plays an important role. Don't underestimate these factors. So I wouldn't say that there are rules, there are the models or things. All what I need to say is, as I said before, the only rule is to understand the situation and try to adjust yourself as a leader to the situation. Understanding the situation means that you need to understand what are the things that you can do, what are the things that you cannot do, and not to treat every single situation the same.
One final question, Alexandre, is a question that many might ask at a professional or other level. How can we make better and faster decisions?
Wow, it's it's a big field. Decision making is a huge field, and it has been approached by a variety of different scientific fields: psychology, behavioral economics, systems thinking. It's a lot of things that you can say here. Look, in your neuroscience, of course. Look, I would say what I'm saying in the book, that if we think that we make daily a lot of decisions. Okay, some of these decisions, very, very important decisions, definitely we have at the moment magnificent technologies to help us. Big data, for example, analysis is one of them. I'm not referring to this type of decisions. Okay, let me clear this out. I'm referring to the decisions that we need to make as managers, as leaders inside organizations, every single day, to collect information around the decision, and based on the analysis of this information, to make the decision. This model, this concept, this idea is clear. The problem is that, first of all, how do you know that you have identified the proper information? One. Two, how do you know that this is enough information in order to make the decision? Three, even if you have a lot of information around the decision, pieces and pieces of information, how do you know that you can analyze this information? So based on these three limitations, my suggestion is, if you want to make faster decisions, not the proper decision of time, but faster decision, try to focus on few pieces of information. Anyway, you cannot process a lot of pieces of information biologically in your brain, and take the decision. Okay, one. Two, if you are not sure, because one thing that definitely blinds our decision-making ability is the biases. There are a lot. There is no any magical way to avoid them. All of us, we have biases. But what you can do is to take the decision, as I said before, based on small portion of information, but do not spell it out. Do not do it. Give yourself the benefit of the doubt and take a pause for 1 minute, for 1 day, for 1 week, for 1 month, depending on the decision, of course. And think about it again. If during your second process of thinking, based on a similar information, you end up with the same result, then do it. Potentially, statistically speaking, most probably you are right. So what I'm suggesting, in order to sum up, don't open yourself in a lot of information in order to take faster decisions. Two, give yourself the benefit of the doubt, take a pause and think again between time one and time two. Of course, leave a little bit of time. How much time, it's up to you to judge. These two, I think, ideas can help you take faster, and statistically, the chances, again, are with you to take most probably the correct decisions. Typical example is, for example, to the evaluation of someone, or whether to do this or the other thing in terms of recruitment, to select someone to do a particular job. All of these things are decisions that they need to be made in a fast way, and many others, hundreds of others. In this kind of decisions, I think that these two rules can help us.
Thank you, Alexandre, for accepting the invitation to the Global Greek Influence podcast and discussing adaptive leadership through the lenses of neuroscience and various context application, from HR to innovative knowledge-intensive companies.
Thank you so much, Panayota, for the invitation. It was really a very interesting discussion, very thoughtful, and I think that your effort is extremely interesting and extremely good. And I think that it will be more and more successful in the future.
Thank you for your kind words and your support. And thank you all for staying until the end. Stay tuned for another podcast episode and get notified by subscribing and following on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and 5 more podcasting platforms. Your feedback and suggestions also help us become better. Until next time.